Welcome back, everyone, to Dissecting Popular IT Nerds. I'm your host, Doug Kameen, and today I'm talking with Eric Scheider, an enterprise architect in the IT space. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Oh, well, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So before we got on the show here, we were talking about the weather, of all things. And so you live in Texas, where it's hot.
Indeed, yeah, we're about 91, 92 right now. So
yeah, and that's like, as a guy who grew up in, I grew up in Austin, Texas myself, although I live in upstate New York now. But that's kind of a relief from a lot of days in the dead of summer, though. 91's kind of like almost refreshing for you.
Indeed, yeah. Originally from Kentucky, we moved down here about 2 years ago.
Okay.
So we did an adventure in 2022. Mm-hmm. Bit of a culture shock from a temperature perspective or weather perspective, based on what we were used to.
Uh-huh. So if I might ask, what prompted you? Like, was it something specific about the Tyler area or something like that that made you, you know, feel like that was where you wanted to be? Or
think of it as it came to a point. My spouse is originally from Texas area, so
that helps.
a lot of family down here, and she had a grandmother that was in the kind of the mid stages of dementia or Alzheimer's.
Mm.
So that was one of the key points: is we wanted to be close to her so that we could help her and her daughters, part of the caregiving aspect. As she transitioned into her final state.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, she has passed.
I'm sorry to hear that.
But we had a celebration of life just this last weekend, so it was a very joyous time. But it turned into the conversation around, okay, what area of Texas do we want to focus on?
Mm-hmm.
Houston, Austin, San Antonio, Dallas. So being close to Dallas, which is where her grandmother's from,
mm-hmm.
We didn't want to be part of that urban life. So we chose a little bit smaller community.
Mm-hmm.
And housing prices, taxes, and school systems were some of the key points that we took into account as part of that decision process.
Mm-hmm.
So Tyler was there.
Now, Tyler is, if I remember from my youth,
uh-huh.
Tyler is known for its roses.
That's correct.
Like, it's like, and I don't remember the details. I just know that there's the Tyler Rose, and do they grow a lot of roses there, or what's the rose story?
Yeah,
as you know it, anyways.
So I don't have a lot of context on the history of why they're the Rose City, but I can tell you from my about 18 months here in Tyler, they definitely, throughout the city, there are large blooms and rose beds all throughout.
They love their roses.
Oh, yeah.
But transitioning a little bit here to your work life, you've been in the healthcare space yourself for quite a while, in various places, working for software companies and organizations doing work with, you know, senior living facilities and nursing homes and stuff like that, if I'm not mistaken, right?
That's correct.
So can you tell us a little bit about you list yourself, you have enterprise architect, which is a term that was, I don't call it new to me, but as a CIO, I've been doing enterprise architecture work for my organization as well. But in your context, what is enterprise architecture? What is enterprise architect in the roles that you're doing?
Yeah, so there are a couple different flavors of enterprise architecture. So the way, if I were to use an analogy, the way that I typically articulate a definition is, you know, think of an enterprise architect as more of a city planner. So city planner is going to provide frameworks and patterns and practices that the city can use as they define different zones and build their cities. You've got other enterprise architects that are focused more on the details. So they're actually laying out pipelines, electrical, and other infrastructure. And then you've got what I would call a third flavor of enterprise architect focused more on business strategy and acting as a liaison between your business and IT partners to help not only drive strategy, but to plan, prioritize, and execute on that strategy. So.
And what, you've done all these roles, or you've specialist in one of them, or you know, tell us more.
Yeah, so from an enterprise architecture perspective, I played a couple of the different flavors of an enterprise architect. One is on the setting the frameworks, guidance, principles, standards, et cetera, that an enterprise uses for various topics. So whether they're going to go with a specific technology, coding patterns and standards, as well as frameworks that they can use or patterns that they can use for repeatable processes. Kind of the bread and butter is more on the strategy execution side. So leading conversations with business partners to help them prioritize their body of work based on, you know, here's our strategy, here's what our KPIs that we're looking to achieve, and then how do we accomplish that? So it's driving into conversations around, I'm a big fan of business architecture. So I leverage the capability models to help drive those conversations, which really focuses on setting a standard language that easily articulates to business or that they can interpret. So you're not talking about specific systems, but you're getting more into concepts or capabilities. So we need to do this goal. It aligns with this outcome. And that essentially aligns with, as an example, I want to do claims processing, or I want to do claims management, or wellness rewards are a couple of good examples. So leveraging that approach allows us to have the conversation with IT on what does our application portfolio look like that enables those capabilities. And then once those goals are essentially established and prioritized, we know what systems or platforms or APIs or technologies that we need to identify in order to either bridge a gap. We don't have the technology to do it today. So we need to introduce new technologies. Two, we need to do an enhancement to an existing system or a platform. And that's essentially what we capture at a high level within a roadmap scenario to identify where they currently are, what their future state is based on how they prioritized what activities need to occur, and then the desired business outcomes.
In my company, where we've been creating, maybe some of these things will sound familiar. We're comparing notes here to figure this out. We built a diagram, an operating model diagram for our business. And then we put together a target state architecture for where we'd like to be. And we've created that we have a technology reference architecture document that goes with it to, how do we align? So the operating model is a very highly generalized diagram about how business flows through our organization and how it's supported by the various business functions that we have. So, in our case, we move through we have three main boxes, sell, implement, and support. And then what happens in each phase of those of the life cycle of that as it moves through our, you know, through our business and who supports what going up from, say, like bottom to top. And then we have a, you know, a target state architecture document that follows a similar like stacked methodology, but then shows the individual technologies or tools that we feel are most important to accomplish those goals. You know, so for example, in our back office application stack under the enterprise resource planning, you know, it's important that we have project accounting, for instance, you know, and we'd have, you know, so we have all these little boxes that indicate all the different things that we care about in that space. And then internally on the IT side, you know, I maintain a technology reference architecture document. It's kind of like a heat map that shows which technologies I feel that are, we need to, you know, like, you know, say, in some of them are very simple, like do our email systems, push notifications, collaboration tools, you know, do we, you know, security monitoring tools, logging tools. And then it's a heat diagram of how I feel we're at relative to where we'd like to be, you know. So like if it's green, we're good. If it's yellow or red, you know, we're working towards it. You know, so like is that, and that's probably, I think you would mention about a couple of different approaches to enterprise architecture. That's more the, I think what I'm describing sounds like it fits more the holistic, like business wide systems architecture for the, from an organizational strategic standpoint.
That's correct. So what we did when I was at Humana is we created an enterprise strategy. So mm-hmm. an enterprise framework from an IT perspective. And one of the components of that, to touch on your point, was around rationalizing our portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
So they had, you know, three or four different claim systems. They had duplicative work or applications that did the same thing. So as part of that strategy from an enterprise perspective, how could we shore up some of those, the application portfolio aspect? So A, we're not only saving the organization money, but we're not having to duplicate requirements across those various systems.
Mm-hmm.
So big part of going back to that capability model, now that's essentially an anchor point, not only to prioritize work or a body of work, but also can be leveraged to provide other insights such as, well, we've got three systems that do the same thing. So it provides insights into how can we rationalize and reduce those number of systems?
Mm-hmm.
Or where do we have gaps? What we need to do X, Y, and Z, and we currently have a bespoke system or application that does it, or nothing at all. So what approach do we take? And it's those insights that allow us to, as an enterprise architect, to influence our business partners and IT partners to help make decisions.
Attention all of my IT leaders who don't know a lot about telecom. Many of you are still managing a pile of junk and you've inherited a telecom silo. I call it a telecom time bomb. Many of us are ignoring it because the enormity of tasks surrounding a phone system replacement is overwhelming, and there's a constant barrage of direct sales reps trying to get you into a new UCaaS system today. And the whole process ends up being filled with an unforeseen comedy of errors. However, for those of you tackling such a task, you must answer, number one, are you going to go Microsoft Teams or are you going to do something else? If it is Teams, then there's only three ways to do it, and the worst way is by just clicking the button and paying that expensive voice-enabling Teams button in your CSP's portal or asking them to do it for you. Okay, so you're not 100% sold on Teams yet because your company has a unique group of end users. Good for you for caring. Then you may be wondering, and you need to answer all of these questions. Which platforms and interfaces have easy to self-manage portals, GUIs, so that you can make moves, ads, and changes on the fly? Which platforms are the most upgradable and have functioning APIs who will truly interoperate with your systems? Who's going to give you free equipment and headsets, of course, and be the most cost-effective? Who's going to support your team the best with fast technical support in minutes, not days? And who's going to meet your compliancy requirements now and in the future with flexible user licensing? How about network preparation, ensuring quality of service? processors and properly layering voice applications? How do you confidently ensure a smooth cutover and avoid going in with your fingers crossed? How do you negotiate all the legal ramifications of FCC-regulated SLAs that affect your terms and conditions? Things like elasticity clauses and out of contracts if they fail to deliver. How do you know what your end users are thinking and how to deal with explaining technical to people 1,000 times that don't know how to do a transfer? And even if you have all this down, what do you do if you have limited time to research, evaluate, and confidently plan a network communications upgrade that will surely impress your key stakeholders with return on investment, CapEx, OpEx, all of this stuff evaluated, and where do you get started in an ocean of vendors? Which provider mix is going to best fit your company's culture versus just asking your peers who they use or shopping VoIP.com or Googling who's the best, and then you've got all kinds of people showing up in your inbox. This is why this is the classic put-off project where no one wants to take on the planning from start to finish, everything from auditing bills to surveying staff, researching providers, sifting through information, meeting with vendors, requesting proposals, ensuring all the effective transition without outages, and managing all of the negative Nancy naysayers who are surely going to complain about the new phone system. Let me and my special team of telecom nerds give you all of the rollout maps, RFP grids, and hold you by the hand for free and even pit providers against them and give you all of the data information on what the lowest pricing has ever been with benchmark level pricing. Everything from seeing how far you can throw those old phone systems to every detail you need surrounding Microsoft Teams integrations or all of the best UCaaS providers with custom and in and out of the box APIs. Also, some of you are dealing with who's the best fit contact center software providers for your unique group of end users and agents and staff. How can you leverage AI software to drastically increase agent efficiency? And let's not forget about workforce management tools to ensure proper staffing, all while avoiding annoying meetings and sales reps telling you it's the end of the month, President's Day specials. All you need to do is email telecom@popularit.net and we will give you all of the information, everything you need, and hold you by the hand for free. And if you like the information, great, do whatever you want with it. And if not, you can tell us to go pound sand.
So this, two things I bring up here. One is that, and I'm, you know, the folks of the podcast won't be able to see this because it's audio, but I'm currently reaching for a book that I'm going to hold up on our chat. But, you know, so I have this book, Enterprise Architecture as Strategy, which is like a, I guess it's kind of considered like the seminal work, if you will, and the foundational work of enterprise architecture, because it's from the mid-2000s, and it was considered like the Bible of enterprise architecture as a corporate strategy book for quite a long time. And I think it fell out of favor, particularly in favor of a lot of agile methodologies of the 2010s, you know, as that really took over how we look at everything, you know, not just software development, but like all the things could be agile. And the enterprise architecture work was kind of fell a little bit by the wayside as a stodgy historical thing, you know, like, oh, well, you know, it's like corporate planning essentially. But
as a barrier, as the way.
Exactly. But I think that it's come full circle now where, in the last couple of years, there's been a high recognition of the value of making sure that you have those plans in place and not just like basically agile hitting everything you got.
So Humana, Optum, and Align all used agile methodologies. And it's really astounding from an enterprise level. I don't know the percentage, but I remember reading this, but majority of your business or product owners aren't in alignment or in agreement on what that strategy is, on what needs to be done. But they have individual goals for their organizational unit to deliver. So they typically will produce insights that their stuff is the most important.
Mm-hmm.
But when you roll it up to an enterprise level and what the organization is supposed to do, you'll often see some contrast there.
Yep. I've had those discussions, you know, the tough discussions with some of the teams to be like, I understand you think this is super important, but like, if we look at it holistically with everyone else, I'm not trying to diminish your value, but in the larger scheme, like your stuff can break and stay broken for a week. And things move along, you know, like you get to have those discussions, like, especially when it comes time to do things like, where do you plan the resources? Where do you, you know, they're like, oh, we need, you know, this crazy expensive backup solution for our product stack. And you're like, do you really need that? Because, you know, the criticality of your system is actually a lot less than the criticality of this other system over here, you know, and
right. Yep, absolutely. And And, you know, going through that prioritization session where we would interact directly with our IT business and leadership and product owners and business partners. Now, it was a conversation where we had them all within the call or conference or whatever the outcome was, but it was essentially getting them to essentially have that internal discussion while we were on the call to say, okay, yes, we can do this, or yes, we can hold off on this. And where I see the benefit from an agile methodology is that concept of iterative delivery. Because oftentimes your business and product owners want to boil the ocean. So they want everything. Whereas if we incrementally introduce value, it not only benefits that organization, but it also benefits the end user, whether that's a customer or internal group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm thinking about the second point I want to make about enterprise architecture is for the podcast here, who our core audience, I would say, is mid-size IT leaders, you know, so 100 to, you know, 1,000, 2,000 employees, you know, that's mid to small enterprise size businesses, large enterprise businesses. And it's not all the time that you end up with enterprise architecture staff at that size, but the value of doing some of the work for enterprise architecture, and we've had a couple of enterprise architects on the on our podcast. I think there was a gentleman probably about 2 months ago who he runs actually an enterprise architects network, collaboration network for enterprise architects, and you know, and Phil Howard, the one of the other co-hosts and founder of the podcast, interviewed him. And the value of enterprise architecture in those small businesses, like even as a CIO, if you can take some of the value and the lessons, because chances are you're doing some of the work already that meets, that is enterprise architecture. So, you know, so for instance, part of the enterprise architecture work, as I understand it, is to be a little bit of the, I don't want to call it the gatekeeper, but you're the keeper of the systems, how they're organized. You know, do we need two systems that do the same thing when two teams show up and ask for it? You know, that's kind of a typical enterprise architecture function where somebody checks in and says, you know what, we have a tool that does X, so we don't need the same tool from another company because, you know, the marketing team likes version A, and the customer engagement team likes version B, and so those types of things are tasks that a lot of these mid-sized CIOs, CTOs are actually conducting, but maybe don't recognize the work as enterprise architecture and collectively pull it together into an enterprise architecture like set of documents. You know, do you have a model of your system? Do you create a basic target state architecture document that lays out the things that, you know, your core systems and how you want to do it? I found it to be an incredibly valuable experience engaging with an enterprise architect consultant myself from my organization, but I was able to quickly map it to some of my prior roles where I was sitting there thinking about, like, oh, when I was, I'm currently a mental health nonprofit CITO, but prior to that, I was a county for municipal counties, a CIO of municipal counties. And like, I did all the enterprise architecture work in my head because that was like, that it was my job to maintain, like, make sure the two departments didn't go by the same thing, to make sure that we built towards a consistent setup, but it wasn't ever documented.
Yeah, absolutely correct. So the approaches that we took during my journey at Humana was couple different things. One, we used an enterprise architecture repository. So it essentially centralized all of the architecture documents. And now architecture is a strata. So you've got the very high level architecture, which is focused more on strategy. And then as you begin to delve down, you get into the concepts, the logicals, physical, and more into the design aspect. So centralizing those aspects and insights on current state as well as future state is a key component. And that's really what's going to drive that communication channel that you have with, and, you know, I work with an architecture community at Humana, where we would corral all of the architects across the organization to essentially talk about new technologies, new concepts, talk through what are some of the challenges that are currently being faced, and then three, present some proposals on current and future state for specific needs.
Mm-hmm.
The other key aspect is, touching on my previous point, is concept. Now, taking a thought process, an ideation process, and drawing out a concept for that to essentially identify its viability. You know, will this work? And then that turns into a conversation with both your business and IT partners on a concept. What Humana was really good with was the values that they prescribed, which two of them that I've focused on, and I continue to focus on them for over 15 years, is, you know, pioneer simplicity. Pioneer simplicity, because oftentimes complex requirements and major features get drawn up, but there's easier ways to do them, and or a majority of the complexity that's often requested is rarely utilized.
Mm.
So that's one. The other one is to rethink routine. So large organizations that are mature, like Humana or an Optum, have always done this particular activity this specific way.
Mm-hmm.
But by introducing a level of curiosity and asking questions and challenging, you know, you can oftentimes get your resources or your architecture team to kind of think outside the box and of different ways of doing the same thing that they've been doing for the last X years.
Mm-hmm.
So two big things that I've done as part of being an enterprise architect, because it's a consultative role, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're essentially there to help drive better outcomes.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important point, and I want to make sure to touch on that so our listeners understand that distinction in your history, that you've filled both roles. Like, you've been an enterprise architecture leader is somebody who is a, you know, oftentimes a strategic individual that interfaces with the IT team and is that bridge between them. But there's also, you've also filled the role of the operations leader in the IT space too here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about, like, your professional background, and just kind of like tell us a little bit how you got to now, if you will, you've had a career of getting into this space. Like, how did you get into enterprise architecture? What were your starting points? How did you get into being in operations leadership in IT?
So I started in the weeds. So initially, in the early part of my career, I was in the developer role. So worked for a few different companies for probably 8 to 10 years as a developer. And as I transitioned into Humana, my professional mentality began to mature. So at that point, I wanted to be challenged and wanted to get less in the weeds and more into what that next level was.
Mm-hmm.
I went through a tech leader where I led onshore and offshore teams, and then rose up through the ranks of an application architect, solution architect, and then into enterprise architecture. Mm. So it was more about getting from, you know, butts in seats, hands on keyboards, into how can I help influence the organization to make decisions as well as driving concepts, cost reductions, and those types of aspects that got me from being a developer into an enterprise architect.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say one of my strengths as an enterprise architect is, and it's kind of my power of influence is what I call it, is acting as a Rosetta Stone.
Mm-hmm. So
having that ability where I not only understand the business acumen, but the technical acumen, and be able to translate very complex concepts into easy to understand language where my business partners could understand it and non-technical resources could understand it, but then be able to dive more into the detail with my IT teams so that I could effectively communicate, this is what they're looking to do, or this is what we need to do. And that's what got me more into, well, what about leadership?
Mm.
Leadership, and you often hear the analogy of being a leader and being a boss. A boss tends to be very micromanagement, provides limited space on the types of things that you should be doing or you can do, whereas a leader is focused on collaborating with your team members, setting them up for success, developing them. As a leader, your goal should be to set a legacy for those that report to you, and by doing that through example. So provide that example for them to build on, but have those conversations with your team members and the community that you are directly related to in order to influence them on providing the right outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Right. So a question popped into my head about your experience. You mentioned you're working with this blended team of onshore and offshore folks. Mm-hmm. And I think a really great thing that to hear feedback on from one of our guests is, what were your biggest challenges in that type of environment? Not all of us end up working in that environment, but sometimes people move into it. So what surprised you about it? What was challenging about it? And what strategies or tactics did you use to overcome and make it work?
Yeah, so a couple of things come to mind. One was obviously the language and cultural barriers.
Mm-hmm.
So 2008, 2009, Humana began to outsource and offshore resources for development work and various roles within the organization.
Mm-hmm.
I had rarely worked with people from offshore prior to that point. So learning the language, learning how they speak, learning their culture was an initial challenge. But what it transitioned into is I got to a position where I'm like, I have 100 free mentors on my floor. Mm-hmm. I'm going to learn their language. So I ended up transitioning that initial barrier into an opportunity to learn the language.
Nice.
And I began to learn the Hindi language, where I could just have basic conversations with many of the resources on the floor, as well as, on conference calls and that. That was a challenge. Two was, we had a lot of great resources that we had contracted into the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And it came to a point where we were transitioning into the offshore model, and a lot of those great resources essentially had to leave the organization. That was a challenge. But if I look at the dividends that it's paid,
mm-hmm.
it has saved the organization money from a development perspective. My best friend is from India. That's been an awesome outcome from the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen a lot of positive outcome with the ability of the teams to be nonstop, where if there's an issue, they get the issue addressed. And they do it quickly, and they'll bring on additional resources if needed, if there's some type of stopgap or emergency that needs to be done.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Awesome. Thanks for sharing. I think it's great to just hear how people have navigated those waters. So I want to just turn us a little bit towards, we're kind of coming up on time here for today's podcast episode, but I always want to make sure to turn to the two last things. So the first of them is maybe a little more lighthearted conversation about our backgrounds and how we got into technologies and other things like that. So I think one of the big questions we always ask guests is, what was your first computer or your first computing experience? And like, how did it change or influence you?
So initially I was into consoles. So mm-hmm. at the time it was the Atari and television. They were the computing resources.
I had a 2600 when I was a kid.
So always been into gaming, still am today. Mm-hmm. But first computer.
Like Pitfall. Pitfall
too. Oh yeah.
I did Pitfall. There you go. That's the stuff right there.
Yeah. First computer was, my mom worked at a bookstore and they did consignment as well as sell books.
Mm-hmm.
In came the ground trembling Timex Sinclair. So it had a whopping 2K of memory, had the little chiclet keys on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I even had the 16K expansion pack. And that it's always been around, you know, how can I solve a problem or how can I do this? And I ended up writing, you know, basic, use basic. So I used basic language to write a address book.
Oh, and nice. You're programming from the time you were a kid.
Yeah. So probably 9th or 10th grade.
Mm-hmm.
Then I went through the ranks where I got into the Commodore 64, Texas Instruments, and then eventually bought my first PC probably early 90s. But it was always trying to overcome a problem or something that I was trying to solve, and it ended up becoming a hobby.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to school, majored in computer science, and then that just really kickstarted my IT career.
All right. Nice. Awesome. Thank you for sharing. Mm-hmm. And last, we always want to ask what advice you would have for other folks, our listeners here, who are moving into leadership or potentially moving into leadership. What advice do you have for them about being a leader and what's important?
And there's a book. I don't have it in front of me, but there was a book I read. It was around radical candor. Not sure mm-hmm. if you had an opportunity to read that book or not, but my advice to individuals wanting to step into an IT leadership role or to a leadership role is to focus on being very empathetic towards your direct reports, you know, having the trust in your IT resources and empowering your resources. Humana did a great job of this, where they would empower direct reports to be able to make decisions as long as you had that thought leadership role and communicated insights to your leadership chain. It's removing the unnecessary levels of approval. Empower your resources. You've got resources that have done something well or resources that have done something poorly. Have that candid conversation with them.
Mm-hmm.
As oftentimes you have resources that get into a annual performance review and they're surprised by hearing the feedback, as opposed to sharing that information during their journey. So there's no surprises as part of the performance review. That's kind of the leadership route that I've taken.
Mm-hmm.
And I would encourage anyone seeking IT to be more of a leader as opposed to a boss.
Thank you for that advice. And thank you for investing your time today with us on the podcast.
Been a pleasure. A pleasure.
So that's a wrap on today's episode of Dissecting Popular IT Nerds. I'm Doug Kameen, and we look forward to coming to you on our next episode.